Blog Talk Radio.
You are now connected to the Christian whistleblower, Jeffrey Dardy.
Taking on 2,000 years of indoctrination, 2 hours at a time.
Sink or swim, deep end information.
Asking questions no one else will.
Parabiblical research, spiritual technology, personal empowerment.
Be your own guru.
Master your own ascension.
Guide your own spirit.
And now, showing you how, the Christian whistleblower, Jeffrey Dardy.
Well, hello there, and have no fear. I know the clip tells you that I'm taking on false doctrine 2 hours at a time. That's in our Wednesday night show. That will be tonight at 9 p.m. See my website for the network details. That's the 2-hour show. This is the Fresh Daily Show, brought to you by Fresh Daily Co. We spend a half an hour. It's a smaller, bite-sized version, if you will, kind of around brunch time here on the East Coast of the United States of America. And we bring this to you 3 days a week at this time. And it's set up to be a smaller, more bite-sized version for those of you that are very busy and don't have time to sit down and listen to the radio for 2 hours at a stretch. So we basically roll out a deeper look, if you will, at the topics covered in the Christian Whistleblower program. And I want to let you know that we welcome your visits to www.jeffreydardy.com, www.christianwhistleblower.com. You can always find out what we're talking about, what's going on, and about anything new that we have to do with. We recommend and welcome you to come to all those places, and we're getting just a huge amount of new followers and visitors. We're very, very happy about that, very, very excited about that. We're also on Twitter, at NC Kabbalah, and of course, on Facebook, Jeffrey Dardy Show. And one of the things that we feature on JeffreyDardy.com, ChristianWhistleblower.com, is the Religion Watch Daily, a compilation of news that is of interest to folks that are interested in religion. And we do encourage you to hit the Contact Us tab to submit your own items, because obviously I miss some things and don't find some things that could be very, very interesting, and we'd love to have you go ahead and submit those. But interesting things on the Religion Watch Daily today: giving up the old God, talking to a friend recently who has experienced some serious doubts about her belief in God, and I found myself saying, the author says, everyone has to give up the old God to find the real one. Now, of course, that's a sentiment with which I would wholeheartedly agree. There's another one here, interesting, fascinating little tidbit that I found from Carl Sagan. And it says, God empties hell this morning by divine decree and without explanation or apology. God announced that he has emptied hell. Go ahead and take a look at that. We do have stories sometimes that are tragic, and tragic in more ways than one. This is certainly a great example of that. Woman beaten to death by exorcist. A 20-year-old woman was beaten to death allegedly by an exorcist in Zanmana village, police there say. That is in India. The IRS wants to know why this pastor owns 5 houses but pays no taxes. And I'm willing to wager that the IRS is not the only one, or are not the only ones, that want to know. Joyce Meyer, a figurehead for the prosperity gospel, has been criticized for over a decade because of the personal wealth that she accumulates from her followers. Though some disapprove of her ministry because she's a woman, many are more disturbed by the lavish lifestyle that she leads with her husband, Dave Meyer. And now the IRS wants to know, so that could get very interesting very quickly. Morgan Freeman asks, if aliens exist, do they worship God? Interesting little tidbit about what Morgan Freeman thinks. And here's one that I thought was especially, It was especially typical. Christian couples file for divorce en masse to defy gay marriage ruling. Thousands of Christian couples, some who have been married for decades, have vowed to file for divorce in the wake of the Supreme Court ruling, which has legalized gay marriage nationwide. So to me, it's not that big of a deal because guess what? About 50% of them, or over 50% of them statistically, were going to file for divorce anyway. So there you have it. Here's one that I really want to talk about, though. Five good reasons to believe that Jesus never existed. And I want to look at this in depth because, you know, we talk about this quite a bit. We talk about this type of a subject matter. We talk about this type of theology and this type of belief. But I am still today of the opinion that Jesus did, in fact, exist. I'm still of the opinion that Jesus did, in fact, exist, even though sorry about that, folks, just a little bit of a snafu there, but as I was saying, I am of the opinion that Jesus did exist, even though the evidence for him having existed continues to dwindle. And the fact of the matter is that even according to the words of Jesus or Yeshua himself, it really does not matter. Now, some of the reasons why many people question the existence of Jesus is that there's absolutely no first century secular evidence whatsoever that supports the actual existence of a man called Yeshua ben Yosef. Not one single shred of evidence mentioned at all by any pagan contemporaries. And pagan, of course, in that definition just means non-Christian. So there's not any mention at all in secular history about Jesus. No birth records, no trial transcripts, no death certificates, no expressions of interest, no heated slanders, no passing references, nothing. And even when the field is broadened to the years after his death, even if you include the entire first century of the Common Era, there's not so much as a solitary reference to Jesus in any non-Christian, non-Jewish source of any kind. And the writer stresses that there is a large number of documents from the time, the writings of poets, philosophers, historians, scientists, government officials, large collections of surviving inscriptions on stone and private letters, legal documents and papyrus, and none of this, this vast array of surviving writings, is Jesus' name even mentioned. Not one shred of secular evidence. There are two or three kind of passing, references from towards the end of the first century, but they're very weak. You can look back on some of my stories and recordings to find those. And, you know, it just it doesn't make any sense because things like virgin births, they tend to get mentioned in the paper. Things like spectacular show trials in the middle of Jerusalem, in the middle of Passover, they tend to make the paper. Crucifixions of local heroes or local cult leaders, if you will, tend to make the paper. And certainly rising from the dead tends to make the local paper, but no first century secular evidence whatsoever that supported the existence of Yeshua. And again, I still am of the opinion that he did exist, at least currently, but there's no first century evidence to suggest it. Even the New Testament seems ignorant of the details of Jesus' life, which becomes more crystallized in later texts. Paul himself doesn't mention the virgin birth, doesn't mention the wise men, star in the east, doesn't mention miracles. Historians call this the silence of Paul on the basic biographical facts and teachings of Jesus. Paul doesn't cite Jesus' authority, even when it would help make his case. And what's more, and this is not from me, this is from a secular source, what's more, Paul never calls the 12 apostles Jesus' disciples. He never says Jesus had disciples. He never says Jesus did miracles or gave teachings. He refuses to disclose any other biographical detail, and the few cryptic hints he offers aren't vague, but contradict the Gospels. The leaders of the early Christian movement in Jerusalem, like Peter and James, who are supposedly Jesus' own followers and family, Paul dismisses them as nobodies and repeatedly opposes them for not being true Christians. Folks, and listen to this. This is the first time that I've ever heard this said by anybody other than me. Really, the very first time I've ever heard this said by anybody but me. Theologian Marcus Borg suggests that people read the books of the New Testament in chronological order to see how early Christianity unfounded. Placing the Gospels after Paul makes it clear that as written documents, they are not the source of early Christianity, but its product. The Gospel of and about Jesus existed before the Gospels. They are the products of early Christian communities several decades after Jesus' historical life and tell us how those communities saw his significance in their historical context. So welcome to the party, theologian Marcus Borg. And the only gospel, the only account that we have of historical Jesus are the Gospels. And we're back to the same old circular argument. The Bible's true because the Bible says it is true. And that's just a very, very poor way to prove anything. And it's certainly a very thin case in any case. So, you know, that's what this, it's on salon.com, 5 good reasons to think Jesus never existed. A growing number of scholars are openly questioning or actively arguing against Jesus' historicity. But see, here's the whole thing, folks. It doesn't matter. Jesus said in John 6:63, my flesh is of no use. If you take it to the original literal rendering, as we have many times, Jesus said, my flesh is worthless. The things of my life, do you take it even more literal? The things of my life, my body, are worthless. It is my message, my teachings that are spirit and life. That's what Jesus was all about, the message that he taught. So it doesn't matter if a historical Jesus ever existed. It doesn't matter if there was a guy walking around in Judea that actually said these things. What we can't argue against, and what is very, very clear, is that a message, a series of messages, a series of teachings has coalesced around a figure that we call Jesus. Whether he was real or not real, really the question. And frankly, not really an issue. Now today, speaking of Paul not even giving courtesy to Jesus' very own disciples, and scarce mention, not to mention Paul calling them non-Christians, which they really were, because Christianity was a holy Pauline creation. But at any rate, we saw that James, this is where we left it last week, where James had given scathing rebukes of the Apostle Paul. All the reaching out and all the trying to bring him in had fallen short and failed. So James writes that a double-souled man with divided interest is unstable in all his ways, a clear reference to a Roman Jew with connections to both temple and Caesar, which of course is what Paul was. In James 1:13-17, we saw that he gave a scathing rebuke of original sin. And then in James chapter 2, verse number 6, he comes out and completely plainly says, there is a rich man that is oppressing you and dragging you before the tribunals. Paul was the heir to Halliburton of the day. He was fantastically wealthy, and he was, by his own admission, oppressing and hauling believers before magistrates. It's a perfect picture of what was going on, because Paul was doing exactly what James was writing about. And James also talks in James 3:13 about the wanton arrogance of Paul. And then in Matthew 4:4, or excuse me, in James 4:4, he also talks about, it does everything but names Saul of Tarsus. So James did his best to bring Saul slash Paul into the household of faith. He extended him much more courtesy and much more patience than really was necessary or even wise. And yet Paul continually refused it, and James was forced to begin to write. And write he did. Those are the things he said. And then Paul begins to respond. And folks, that writing of James, the book of James, was the very first book of the New Testament in chronological order. That can't be overstated. So the very first book of the New Testament in chronological order was written in large part to bust out Paul, to show that Paul was a two-souled man with divided interests, to show that Paul's doctrine of original sin was wrong, to show and identify Paul as a rich guy oppressing the church, which was a inevitable historical fact, biblically speaking, and to show that Paul was wantonly arrogant. So that was the very first book of the New Testament. And you're sitting there thinking, wow, this is the very first book of the New Testament, and the very first book is talking about Paul being all these things. And it really just makes you wonder, that's because you've been sold a bill of goods. And then Paul responds. Paul responds to that ferocious tongue lashing from James, and he responds in a letter to the Thessalonians. And that itself is very, very interesting, because Thessalonica, or Salonica, was the second largest city in Greece, and it was the capital of the Greek region of Macedonia, and it was a long way from Jerusalem. It was a long way from Jerusalem. So here's James, located in Jerusalem, writing a scathing letter, accusing, rebuking, outing, if you will, the Apostle Paul. Paul gets wind of it and responds by writing to Thessalonica. Why? Why didn't he write to Jerusalem? Why didn't he send his letter to Jerusalem? Why didn't he go to Jerusalem? Because he didn't care about Jerusalem. He wasn't interested in Jerusalem. He wasn't interested in being a part of the ministry of the apostles that was going on in Jerusalem. He was out in Greece doing his own thing, creating his own band, if you will. He was starting his own religion. So he didn't write to Jerusalem. He didn't respond to Jerusalem. He didn't go to Jerusalem because he wasn't looking to be a part of the original Yeshua movement. He was looking to oppose it. So he writes his first letter to the Thessalonians, to Thessalonica. You've got to understand the significance of things like that, things you've never been told, to create a story that you've been sold, rather than the real story and the real timeline. But at any rate, Paul does decide to respond, and he responds in 1 Thessalonians. And we're just going to read these, and you can decide for yourself if Paul is in fact responding to the Apostle James or not. We'll just let you understand. We'll let you make that decision. Of course, I'll probably assist you just a little bit, but Paul responds. We're looking at 1 Thessalonians, and this is a book, of course, that was written to Thessalonica. James was published in A.D. 47, 1 Thessalonians in A.D. 52, 2 Thessalonians in A.D. 53. So the second and third books of the New Testament are 1 and 2 Thessalonians. The first book of the New Testament was the book of James. And in 1 Thessalonians chapter 2 and verse number 3, Paul says, "For our exhortation is not of deceit, nor of uncleanness, nor of guile." That calls your mind right back to James 3:13, where James says that Paul speaks of deceit, Paul speaks with uncleanness, Paul speaks with guile. So in the second chapter of the first book that Paul ever wrote, he gives a direct refutation to something that James said about him. You can almost hear him say, "Nuh-uh, nuh-uh, it's not true." He's responding directly to the Apostle James. And then in verses 14 through 18 of the same chapter, chapter 2, he goes on again and says, "For you, brothers, became followers of the churches which in Judea are in Christ. For also you suffered like things of your own countrymen. They killed Jesus. They killed their own prophets. They persecute us, and they don't please God. They're contrary to all men. They don't want us to speak to the Gentiles because they don't want their sins to be filled up. They don't want the wrath coming upon them. But we, brethren, we know that we were taken from you in a short time in presence, but not in heart. We've endeavored to be more abundant, to see you face to face, whereof I would even come to you." So Paul is saying, listen, those people in Jerusalem, you know, those ones that killed Jesus, those ones that persecute us, they don't even want to please God. They're contrary to all men, and they're trying to keep us from talking to you. Folks, do you understand what you are reading? Paul is giving in the very first writing he ever gave, he's giving a very strong refutation of the apostles in Jerusalem. Do you see that? It's amazing. It's amazing. And Paul's saying, you know, "I would have liked to have gone and talked to you, but Satan hindered us." Who's Satan? Who was hindering him? Your brethren, the followers of the churches in Judea, are hindering him. He's equating the church in Judea with Satan. Or, of course, as it's really rendered, an adversary. Yeshua called the entity that created Pauline Christianity, the spiritual entity, an adversary. Paul is calling the Jerusalem church an adversary. Folks, they were adversarial one to another. The church of Yeshua, the original Yeshua movement, was adversarial to the Pauline movement. The Pauline movement was adversarial to the original Yeshua movement. The two did not play nice together. The two were in opposition. And when you read the New Testament in chronological order, you cannot help but see the truth. That's why I've been begging you to do it for lo now 2 or 3 years. Paul clearly calls the Jerusalem church an adversary of his. James clearly called Paul an adversary of the Yeshua movement. And Paul is in big trouble here, folks. You've got to understand, Paul's in big trouble here. He has overplayed his hand, and he's got himself into a position now where the apostles are not just ignoring him, they're opposing him. And the fact that the apostles are opposing him is highly problematic for him. So he has to do something to change the narrative. He has to do something to get this emphasis off of him being a false apostle. And what does he do? In 1 Thessalonians 4:16, he completely changes the narrative. He completely changes the focus. And he goes to something, he invents something out of whole cloth that has come to be known today as the rapture. Paul, in response to increasing pressure from the Jerusalem church and the apostles of Yeshua, questioning his validity, creates a diversionary doctrine, a diversionary topic to deflect the questioning of his self-appointed apostleship, and he comes up with a fantastical tale, cacular story about the rapture, and he starts weaving this tale in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 and verse number 16. That's where he begins to weave this fantastical tale in the very first writing that he ever gave to the New Testament, after responding directly to the rebuke of the Apostle James, and then responding by calling the entire Jerusalem church adversaries, Satan, and people that are fighting against him. So James says Paul is wrong and gives good reason for it. He's arrogant, double-souled. He's rich. He is persecuting us. And then Paul just says, nuh-uh, and says, you guys are a bunch of devils. And then he says, wow, it's getting hot in here. Let me create a diversionary tactic. Let me come up with this thing called the rapture.
Stay connected with the Christian Whistleblower at www.christianwhistleblower.com. On Facebook, follow Jeffrey Darty and Jeffrey Darty Show.